Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
If Ray Dalio describes you as a vacuum cleaner of learning, you might pause to decipher its implications. When you discover that this individual's rapid career ascent has taken her to become co-head of sustainable investing and partner at Bridgewater, one of the world's largest hedge funds with a staggering $160 billion of assets, having previously overseen a team of 150 investment professionals researching and building systematic strategies to trade global financial markets, and be named in Fortune's 40 Under 40 Most Influential Leaders in Business, and been in Barron's list of most influential women in U.S. finance for 3 years in a row, you can see why learning for her has translated into meteoric progress. So from Westport, Connecticut, it's a great pleasure today to welcome Karen Carneal-Tambour to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Simon.
I understand you were born and raised in Israel. Why did you make the leap to the USA?
I was tremendously curious about this idea of a liberal arts education, if you will, where you don't decide what you're going to do right when you join university. So I really was fascinated to go to school in the United States and have an opportunity to get that kind of education. I was sort of interested in everything. And I didn't like this idea of the European model where you did one thing and one thing only. And I remember, and this is something that I think would never happen today because there's so much more information online. I got into Princeton and they sent us physically in the mail via FedEx, the physical course catalog. I probably spent a month reading this course catalog because I just couldn't believe the breadth of things that I could choose from. It was just the most exciting thing. So I was excited to go to school in the US, came there for college in Princeton and never went back.
So most of us meander through university, but you graduate from Princeton's University's Woodrow Wilson School, where you studied under the Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, and you were awarded the Gail F. Johnson Prize in Public Affairs. So no meandering, I'm thinking, more like sprinting. So what was the one word you would use to describe Princeton?
I actually would have completely said meandering, because it used to be the Woodrow Wilson School, now SPIA, School of Public Affairs. It was this amazing place that let you take any classes you wanted as long as you could prove it had relevance for public policy. I mean, I took optimization classes because that could be connected to public policy. Of course, I took more classic policy classes. I took some economics. I took anything I found interesting and it all could be connected. They had us do these policy papers on an actually relevant topic. And I did one on the 9/11 Commission, one on game theory with North Korea, which of course is still relevant today. And then I was tremendously lucky to get Professor Danny Kahneman as an advisor. He took me, even though I had almost no psychology background, and what I wrote had almost nothing to do with what I learned. If I had to say one thing about Princeton, it is just an incredibly intellectually engaging place.
I think there's a difference straight away I've learned between you and me is that you meander quickly and I meander slowly. So on graduating, you're unquestionably smart, ambitious, educated, and at your feet lie multiple career possibilities. How did you arrive at Bridgewater?
Wow, completely unexpected, honestly. It seemed like if you were a smart person that didn't know what they wanted to do with their life, you would go into consulting. That's what you did if you didn't know what you wanted to do with your life. And the finance people seemed like a different breed. They knew they wanted to do this. And this is 2006. So I want to say Lehman Brothers probably hired 30 people for my Princeton class. And that seemed like a very safe job to take. So I assumed I would do consulting. I had all kinds of offers. But truthfully, I thought I would just go back to academia and this would be a short break. And I remember talking to Danny, Professor Carmen, about it and him saying, I think getting a job one time, even if then you go to grad school, that's a good idea. I got very, very lucky with my academic career. Try a job. I'll write you your recommendations for if you want to come back. And I wandered into the Bridgewater information session almost randomly. My now husband, then boyfriend, knew some people there. Right away, it seemed nothing like any of the finance information sessions I'd ever seen. It had a completely different vibe. And I remember relatively young people talking about playing the hardest game of the world, trying to beat markets. Just the intellectual energy, the interest they had, the curiosity, and the sense that they were their own bosses trying to figure out what was going on in the world. I thought, I have to apply to this place, but it seems crazy. When I got the job, I think everyone in my life thought this was a terrible idea. Four different people bought me the book When Genius Failed to tell me that hedge funds are just a very bad career choice. It's a bunch of overconfident men that are going to end up blowing themselves up anyway. But I figured, I don't know if I'm doing this for the rest of my life. This seems cool. I'm going to give it a try. And of course, I came and fell in love.
Well, let's jump into the world of investing. How would you summarize their historic approach?
Bridgewater, I think, is the only firm I've ever seen that is truly, deeply as committed to being fundamental as being systematic. So we don't invest in anything we don't fundamentally understand. Like, really tell me, what are the cause-effect relationships? So look at the world and say, why is the world going to play out a certain way? What are the things that will drive it to happen? What literal levers will be pulled that will cause things to happen in the world that will then lead to asset returns to play out a certain way? Of course, there are a lot of fundamental people. You turn on TV, you have people talk about what they think will happen in the world. But Bridgewater is equally committed to truly making that investing systematic, which means if you and I are going to chat here, I'm sure, about lots of markets and do a trip of all the big asset markets, talk what's going to happen there. We think that's just a good start. What you want to do is take your ideas, which everyone loves their ideas and thinks they're amazing and brilliant, and try to actually stress test them. Actually try to put them down, write them down, be as explicit as possible about those relationships. What are you saying is going to lead to what and why? When you do that, a few things happen. One is there are just more things that matter in the world than what you could possibly hold in your head. So now you're actually using the power of computing and so on to capture all your ideas together at once. You don't have to get up in the morning and remember everything you thought of before. You can keep a lot more in your mind. You can look at a much bigger sample size. So you can look at, well, when did a circumstance like this ever happen before? How did that play out? Feed your mind by stress testing that idea. And then other people can be part of that process. So it's very different than being a lone portfolio manager, that whatever's in your mind, you decide to go buy something, you buy it. Any ideas need to be put out there, written explicitly, so anybody can critique them, question them, find improvements. And that combination of being really deeply fundamental, so really being connected to understanding why you think the world is going to work the way it does, and at the same time, fully committed to being systematic, I think is very unique and I think allows us tremendous diversification. Because one set of understanding about how the world works, you can now look at any country in the world and say, what are the circumstances there today? They're going to be different. You can have built-in diversification to take opportunities wherever you see them.
I'm really interested because one could argue that we're at a juncture in markets and maybe not a short-term juncture. So let's talk about asset allocation and we can dive down into the categories, but let's discuss the investment battlefield. Is there a changing of the guard?
Absolutely. I think the biggest changing of the guard currently happening, and there are a few dynamics, but probably the biggest one is that, to be blunt, inflation just hasn't mattered in about 40 years. So most of the investing history that people have, they've personally experienced and remember and have gotten used to things, is when inflation didn't matter. And that was very important because It really determined what correlations you saw between assets. So take the example of stocks and bonds. Stocks and bonds in a world of no inflation are very negatively correlated. So you get accustomed to this world where having bonds is really helpful relative to having stocks in terms of its diversifying. A lot of times stocks fall and bonds actually rally at the same time the yields fall. But in periods of high inflation, things don't look that way. You can look at all sorts of correlations the same way, commodities and stocks. So a lot of our investment history, we're sort of in this paradigm where growth was the most important thing. The other piece that comes with that is that central banks really were not very constrained. Because if you think about a central bank, they're trying to do two things, maximize employment, make sure inflation doesn't get out of control. If inflation is not even close to getting out of control, it can just do everything in its power to make sure growth is great. So no matter how bad the growth hits, financial crisis, COVID, you can print money, you can coordinate with the fiscal authorities, you can really go all out. You don't have any constraints on you because the only job you have is keep growth good. Once inflation is high, suddenly you have constraints. You actually need to accomplish two things at once, keep the economy going and keep inflation under control. So that mix of circumstances where central banks are more constrained and inflation is actually an important driver really changes the investment landscape, or the guard, to use your language, in terms of how related assets are to one another, and therefore how to build a reasonable asset allocation to take you through that. And to be blunt, it makes most assets people hold just not that attractive right now. Most assets have been attractive for a long time because they could be supported by central banks, they could do well in low inflation periods.
It's so easy, and I'm tempted often to refer back to historic periods, and for most people they go straight back to the 70s, but the 1970s had rigidities that you don't have today. So how are you thinking about this framework? Are there parallels that are useful?
I think that the 70s are a really useful analogy. And of course, there's many differences, and it's easy to talk about those differences. You had this unionized labor force, and you had an economy that wasn't digitized. So it's easy to find all the differences. And I'm not saying 1970s are exactly like today. Commodities were a much bigger part of the economy. But I think it's a really valuable analogy to think about, because you basically had inflation getting higher than it had been in a long time, starting because of strong demand coming from a mix of fiscal and monetary policies, basically guns and butter type policies, and a time where people weren't used to it. So it wasn't in people's psychology to worry too much about inflation. So into that environment, you get these commodity shocks coming from a very external factor, time coming from the Middle East. And you see that central banks don't love tightening into that environment because commodity shocks feel exogenous. It's not related to the economy. It's not demand driven. And no one has lived with inflation for a long time. So just the fear of inflation is just lesser than it had been. And what you end up seeing in the 70s is just, it takes a long time for policymakers to realize that inflation is entrenched, it's self-reinforcing, that even the exogenous pieces that are supply driven, they do exacerbate what's going on. They don't go away in a day. And central banks just lag, you know, over and over again. They always end up tightening more than people expect. And more importantly, portfolios just do terribly because bonds do terribly because you keep getting this tightening. And equities do terribly because stocks don't do particularly well with rising interest rates and high inflation. So even if today doesn't play out exactly like the 70s, which doesn't need to, it does definitely tell you a lot about the psychology of how long it takes to really tighten aggressively into circumstances like today, and how bad and for how long it can be for investors if you live through decades like that.
Would it be fair to say the Fed really has, by its own making, got itself between a rock and a hard place? Because it should have tightened earlier. Inflation's now ripped, and even though I think consensus would have it coming back, I guess the question is, might just settle at a higher level than many people think, and then it hasn't got any ammunition to cut into the next downturn. So how are you processing the Fed's very vulnerable position?
I think you said it well, very vulnerable. It's taken them a long time to realize that inflation is a real challenge. And then they did get unlucky with Russia invading Ukraine, because that took what was an inflationary problem that was mostly demand-driven. People talked about supply constraints, but they were happening because demand was just so powerful that we wanted more and more and more stuff. So supply of everything felt constrained, but actually more and more was being supplied than ever before because demand was so powerful. And it took a while for the Fed to catch up and realize how entrenched that inflation is, how fast wages were growing, how much that wage price spiral can work. And then got someone unlucky. Russia invades Ukraine. Now you have actual supply constraints where supply really comes out. Commodities are less important than they were in the 70s, but still important. Russia and the Ukraine are suppliers of a lot of important global goods, a lot of them underappreciated. Everyone talks about oil, but you have food, you have things in the metals complex. Now you're getting actually exogenous supply shocks into this that are just going to exacerbate the problem. So the Fed is in a place where it's only catching up to what it'll need to do. And if you take the markets as a reasonable read of what the Fed said it would do and where the Fed is, I think now the Fed is very much expected to be catching up and tightening, but only for a very short period. So the markets are basically pricing a good amount of tightening for about a year. That makes sense. And the Fed really ought to do that. They got to at least do that. But it's basically pricing in that within a couple months of the Fed doing this tightening, that's it. Inflation is going to come back down, nothing to worry about, and no more tightening, maybe even a little easing once you're a year out. And that set of circumstances seems pretty unlikely to me. It's much more likely they'll be in very constrained circumstances where growth is slowing and yet inflation remains pretty entrenched. And they're forced to tighten into tougher and tougher conditions where they're actually putting their employment mandate more and more at risk.
So dominant swathes of the investing world, both institutional and individual, have a variation of the 60-40 portfolio, 60 equity, 40 debt, and looked fine, as you said earlier on, in a world that was significantly more benign. What do you think is the right portfolio today?
The key thing missing from a 60 portfolio is inflation protection. And you could even say deflation protection, but or stagflation protection. The thing that's really missing is inflation protection. And it's not easy to get. But there are a handful of assets that can do that. So if you start with people are already holding big allocations to nominal bonds are probably the single worst asset you could hold. At the very least, I would switch them to inflation-linked bonds because now at least whatever CPI prints, you're going to get paid that. You could say, I don't believe what Karen is saying. I think inflation is definitely coming down, not going to be entrenched. If that happens, you're no worse off. That's what's currently priced in nominal bonds. But if you're wrong, and inflation actually ends up being higher than that, at least you'll get paid whatever it is CPI prints. So that's a little bit of a win-win situation. To me, inflation-linked bonds are probably the best stagflation assets that one could own and are pretty under-owned relative to how valuable they could be. And then you go to commodities. And I think commodities are really interesting because in a world of no inflation, I think commodities for a lot of investors seem like bad equities. They were pretty correlated, but there wasn't a lot of reason to think they had the same degree of risk premium. So you got a lot more excited betting on tech than holding raw commodities. Why are you holding this? But if you look at periods where inflation is high, they don't look correlated anymore. And of course, they haven't been very correlated in recent months because you're getting higher inflation. If you are worried at all about exposure to rising inflation, which with a 60-40, you really don't have a lot of protection, it's hard to get away from just literally hold the raw materials that are part of making an economy work. Just hold those raw materials in that raw form. And the more squeezes there are, the more we need to keep coming up with more raw materials, the more those prices will go up. And when I look at what's happening in the world, there's such a massive need to rebuild infrastructure, do physical capital expenditures, change the physical outlays in many ways, in ways that won't even necessarily increase productivity. They're because of security issues and concerns about politics, and sometimes because actually we've underinvested in the physical economy. But this huge demand to go rebuild physical things is happening at a time where it's not like so much of this raw materials are lying around. We've spent many years not investing in getting them out of the ground. So probably commodities and inflation-linked bonds seal to me like the things most missing from strategic asset allocation in this environment.
So let's stay with commodities, because I think it's fair to say that because the indices that reflect commodities are heavily skewed towards oil, people don't often look much beyond that. And as you said, we've got low inventories, we've got real supply shortfall, and we've got demand that is, you could argue, in a secular uptrend or continued uptrend, just thinking about electrification alone. How are you breaking up the world of commodities and how are you allocating?
Well, as you said, most of the indices people look at are very energy dominated. And regardless of any view you have on energy, I don't see any reason to hold an index that's so concentrated. It also doesn't make sense to hold your stocks so concentrated in one country or one sector. People just haven't thought that much about building their own index. But the oil market in particular, it's idiosyncratic. You get a lot of political risks. You have a big cartel called OPEC Plus. You have shale in the United States, which could come on very quickly and affect the supply. And it's only one of many commodities that we use in the economy. So one commodity I think people almost never talk about, the second most used commodity after oil, is actually iron ore, because you use it to make steel. And most Western investors don't own it for a very funny reason, which is just that the market has always been in China. That's just the place where it's been a big liquid market. But if you just said, line up everything we use in the real economy, what are the biggest commodity markets that are part of making our economy run? You'd say oil, then you'd say steel, iron ore. And we just happen to not be in that market because in China, but it's open now and foreign investors can invest in it. And then I go to the mix of metals. I think the mix of metals are very interesting because they get used in a lot of things. There is big secular pressure on the whole metals complex, primarily, I think, because of the transition to wanting to decarbonize the economy. You really need a lot of these metals in order to get electric vehicles and solar panels and all that. You can build a pretty diversified mix of them. And unlike oil, where you have this magical thing called shale, where relatively quickly you can decide to drill a well and it'll come out. In metals, there's no magic like that yet. It takes a long time to get a mine to get things out. So when you have a supply-demand problem, it really is, if demand is stronger, if there are inflationary pressures, you're stuck. You have to ration demand. The only mechanism to do it is price. I think there's a lot of different thoughts investors have about their effect in investing in food and looking at food as a complex. But I think it's at least interesting. Obviously, a lot's already happened in food because Russia and the Ukraine are just such huge producers. At least the market should be watched, obviously an important part of the global commodity market. And what's happening today will probably be a big part of world upheaval, if you will, partly in economies a lot of us don't invest in. But if you look at the last time you had anything like this pressure on global food, you got a lot of social upheaval, the big driver of why you had the Arab Spring. So that feels like an important and very differentiated set of commodities as well. And I should say, it's very rare to get an upheaval like you do now with Russia, Ukraine, where one producer is important to all of these and has a medium to long-term problem, depending on if you're talking about Ukraine or Russia or people's views or the fighting, that disrupts supply in so many important ways across all the commodities.
So let's go back to the 60 bit of that typical portfolio. You have made the point that valuations are unattractive, but maybe I can press you on that because US valuations by historic standards do not look attractive, but that is not the case for many parts of Asia and the UK. So how are you processing that?
First of all, I should say I certainly still hold equities in a strategic asset allocation. You're right that across countries, the US looks like maybe the least attractive major country because the US has outperformed for so long for fundamental reasons also because you had real explosion of the digitized economy be centered in the United States. The problem is that's already priced in to continue in the future. So markets are already extrapolating that the United States economy is going to continue basically being the strongest and most innovative, use whatever superlative you want, for quite a long time. So to actually outperform those expectations relative to other people is going to be a pretty high bar. So you're buying in already with a lot of expectations of U.S. exceptionalism and so on and so forth. I certainly like a lot of equity markets much more than that because that's just not priced into that extreme anywhere else.
I do remember the Japanese bull market, which ended in 89, and as it had its long secular bear market, so the US enjoyed this long secular bull market. Now, the starting points were pronounced, but you take a place like China, and I think Ray Dalio has been on record as being quite excited about the opportunities in China. And could one see a similar and marked divergence between those two markets?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at the history. One of the most reliable things you can see is that whoever was the outperforming country in the last decade is basically never the outperforming country again. You get these flip-flops. And the reason is that markets tend to extrapolate what just happened. So pretty reliably, whoever's been the performer gets priced in to continue and you get a reversal. What that means, which is pretty remarkable, and we've shown this back to the 1800s, is if you have a geographically diversified mix of assets, that's basically as good as picking the best country every time. Because you end up actually not needing to pick. You end up getting the best of the best because you end up actually being diversified. And that means you have to build it differently from the index. Because you gave the Japan example. When Japan was in a huge bubble, the index became very, very, very Japanese. If you just bought the index, you end up with way too much Japan exposure. So we actually, when we think about building equity portfolios, we think of country diversification as a very important first-class thing, more important in many ways than sector diversification and worrying about company concentration. Because the more you get different countries, you actually get different credit systems, different macro backdrop, and you tend to get different pricing, and you get these flip-flops as you described. Then if you go to the China example in particular, obviously there's a lot of idiosyncratic risk with China. We could end up legislating that it's illegal to hold Chinese assets. But what we do know is that China is probably the biggest opportunity for diversification that's available because you have a huge economy that very much beats to its own drum because you have a monetary policy and a fiscal policy that can really be set for China and not a ton of capital flows in and out. So if you could get the perfect diversification by going to Mars, it had nothing to do with what was going on in the United States. China's not going to Mars, but it's a lot closer than going to Europe where you have much more interconnections. let alone going to Canada or going to the UK. It's a really big opportunity for diversification. I think the equities are paid too much attention to relative to the bonds in China, because that's another big opportunity for diversification that's less political. You're less worried about, are these companies that are involved in security issues and so on, interest rates are just higher, they have room to fall. But either way, Chinese markets are just an area where foreign investors have not been in that much. And if you're looking for opportunities for true diversification, a country that really has its own monetary and fiscal policy is the biggest opportunity you'll get.
And I noted earlier in the year that there was record insider buying in Hong Kong, and the parallel was record insider selling in the US. So there we go. I want to talk about something that I know you like and I like, and that's currencies. And not everybody likes talking about currencies. When I started to age me in the mid-1980s, currency mattered much more as a source of return. Now, if assets stagnate or tread water, currency might be more important. But my first question to you is, how do you think about currencies at Bridgewater?
Well, I think the biggest fundamental difference I have from Bridgewater, from a lot of investors we talk to, is that we always explicitly separate the currency decision from the asset. We were talking before about thinking US stocks are less attractive. A lot of US investors, if they think that, they just go buy European or Chinese stocks and don't even think about the currency decision. They just go and buy those stocks. And we just consider those fundamentally different decisions. You don't need to hold European stocks with an exposure to the euro. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that for most investors, you want to always start by saying, what is actually my risk neutral position? If I'm not taking a view, what is actually risk neutral for me? And for a lot of investors, global spending power is actually what's important to them. If their currency falls a lot, that matters. They won't be able to afford going abroad, vacations, foreign goods. So for most investors, some global currency mix is actually more of a risk neutral position than actually having a proactive alpha view. And then the last piece, as you sort of implied, is the alpha view. How much is this currency going to move and how confident am I in that decision? And as you've noted, it just hasn't felt like it mattered much because currencies have not moved that much. Getting the kind of moves we've gotten since Russia invaded Ukraine in currencies feels big. Feels like a lot's happening in currency markets. But those used to be moderate moves that happened all the time. And I think one of the big drivers of it connects to what we talked about before, which is dominance of inflation. When inflation is more dominant and different across countries, you actually get bigger shifts, which currencies fall and rise. So it can matter a lot. And in the 70s and 80s, it was not possible to invest in equities and not ask this question, because sometimes whether you hedged or didn't hedge your equities mattered more than which country you picked.
And I did check because I wanted to make sure that I was right, but I'm pretty close to saying that since 1985, the dollar has lost 70% of its value against the Swiss franc. So that might have been concentrated in the first half of that period, but these are big moves. And we've got now the yen, I think, is furthest away from purchasing power parity that's been in the last 40 years. So do you actually rank the currencies that you like most right now?
We always have an active view about which currencies are attractive, but the strategic view of what do you want to hold over 10 years would differ a lot from what do you want to hold on a three-month basis. So on a three-month basis, the most dominant influences are very much flows. One of the things that's great about currencies and makes it a really great market to have alpha views is that in equities, everyone's buying a stock thinking they know something about the company, about the product. Basically, everybody else are smart people like you trying to figure out what will happen to the company. In a currency, that's not the case. If someone goes out and decides to buy a Honda because they like the Honda, they're not thinking, I have a view about the yen versus PPP at all. They're just going about doing their business, and part of that is a currency transaction. So you have a lot of players that are transacting for reasons other than that. So on any short-term period, the dominant driver of the currencies is going to be, in that moment, who are the buyers, who are the sellers, what's happening when people are making choices to buy stocks, are they hedging them? When people are going out and deciding to buy imports or buy exports, what are they doing? And you get big current account balances, you get all sorts of big flows dynamics that make currencies predictable. In a longer term perspective, a lot of the flows that are day-to-day matter less, and you get longer term dynamics. And issues like what is priced competitively and where is actually the world going to go in terms of what it's holding matters a lot. So take the dollar. I would say I actually have really liked the dollar in the short term, but in any medium term perspective, the dollar starts looking extremely vulnerable. There's way too many people in dollars relative to the importance of the United States to the global economy. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion right now about dollar reserves having been weaponized. So I might rank it number one in the near term, and then medium term say, I'm pretty sure most investors listening to this podcast have too much dollar exposure.
Which brings us very nicely to my currency of choice, which is gold. I'm surprised how many calls I've had from people saying, gosh, you know, hasn't really gone up as much as you'd have thought with Ukraine. And yet, isn't that to mistake it, that its role is to preserve purchasing power? It's not portfolio insurance. So shouldn't we think about gold as a currency?
I think we absolutely should. It's a much better way to think about gold. Because as you're saying, this is a real asset. And the main question is, has it lost its value? Has inflation really outpaced it? Have you been able to keep the value of your assets if you denominate them in gold? Now, like any other asset, there are, of course, buyers and sellers. So you can get bigger gold moves than that. But holding gold, expecting it to massively outpace inflation, doesn't make a whole lot of conceptual sense. And thinking about it as a currency is pretty useful because you go and think about all of the problems with the fiat currencies we have and the needs we've had to devalue them. The fact that, honestly, inflation being higher now, it's not a lot of benefits. The magic any central bank would want was give me high inflation without anybody thinking it'll stay high. So let me just wipe out some debts right now. But without getting it out of control, my bond yields won't even rise because no one's going to think inflation is going to stay high. Well, if you live in that world, you're still losing purchasing power and still a pretty good time to denominate real assets, which gold is the easiest way to do that.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine. And as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. Let's talk about sustainable investing. You are co-CIO of Bridgewater Sustainable Investing. When we had a call last week, you said something, if I recollect it, you have a unique approach. Now, I'm a old saw, so when people use the word unique, I think of things which are termed enthusiastically but inaccurately because not many things are unique. Tell me why your approach is so special.
Let me say it like this. I think sustainable investing is in its infancy, but it's something that a lot of investors feel very strongly about and are making long-term commitments to. So I think it'll keep evolving. A large percentage of investing will be sustainable investing. When I go back on your podcast in 10 years, which I hope will happen, we won't have a section on sustainable investing. It'll just be what a lot of people do, and it'll just be a big part of how they invest. But in its infancy, you get a lot of arguments that don't make a lot of sense to me, to be honest, which basically sound like, I'm always going to make you more money if I'm more sustainable. There's no way to make money if you're not sustainable. You make money if you're sustainable. Those arguments just don't make a lot of sense to me because I've been doing this for long enough that there's no one factor that will always tell you when you'll make money. It doesn't matter if it's sustainability. It doesn't matter if it makes you feel good. There's no one factor. Markets are going to go up. Markets are going to go down. There's going to be a lot of factors. The world is complex and a lot of things are going to drive the world. So we basically came at it saying, okay, number one, you absolutely need to deeply understand the world. And the world is certainly changing such that sustainability considerations are becoming larger drivers than they've ever been in the past of what will determine asset returns. So I remember Ray Dalio put out a piece some number of years ago on populism. And we got all these questions like, why are you guys writing about populism? Like, how could this be relevant for a hedge fund? We said, well, look, it really feels to us like the quality of governance is becoming a really important issue. And we weren't coming at it like, we have to go do ESG now. It just actually look at the world and it's clearly becoming important. And the quality of governance has mattered a lot over that period. And similarly, it's hard to look at the world and not think that every policymaker, that different investors, that a lot of people are responding to climate change in the choices that they're making. So you'd be silly not to think that climate change is going to have a significant impact when it's both affecting the physical world and affecting the players in it. So there's one world which is, look, you have to always deeply understand what's happening in the world. That's our fundamental approach. And more sustainability topics are simply becoming important. But when I say we have a unique approach to sustainable investing, I think it's really the second issue, which is we have come out and said, look, if you want to say, I have a sustainability goal, and more investors are explicitly saying that. The most common form of that is net zero, saying I want to be a part of moving the economy toward net zero. But there are many versions that we could talk about. Investors saying, I care about the impact of my money. I don't only care about making money. I also care about the impact of it. We've said, look, that's really an engineering problem. That's really a portfolio engineering problem that is complex and needs to be thought through. Because whenever you add more goals, more constraints, more things you want to do, you really have to be thoughtful about engineering wisely for those goals to basically make sure you don't lose more diversification. So the first thing we set out to do when we started sustainable investing was actually to say, look, Bridgewater's strategic asset allocation for 40 years has been what we call all weather. Ray started it as a way to preserve his own family's wealth when he thought, how will I preserve my family's wealth most effectively? And now it has a very long track record in the market saying this is the way we really believe is the right way to have a strategic asset allocation. We said, how about we build this only out of sustainable assets? Could we rebuild a strategic asset allocation out of sustainable assets? And we didn't know at first. We thought it might be too hard to do. You might lose too much diversification. It might not be doable. And this is where we came to the realization, this is very much an engineering problem. It's actually plausible to add a very high bar in sustainability. It's a high bar and it's a lot of quote unquote constraints if you then engineer wisely and still build in diversification and build in strategic asset allocation. So we've basically shown that you can build what we're calling all-weather sustainability or achieve the same idea with sustainable assets. And that's why I think the approach of saying there's understanding the world, which is very important, sustainability is a big part of it, but there's also just engineering your portfolio wisely to the new goals investors want to achieve, I think is a unique and very powerful approach.
So you launched this all-weather sustainability fund, but how do you wrestle with these dilemmas about inclusion and exclusion and companies in transition? Because it's a minefield.
Our approach was always, let's apply the same Bridgewater investment principles. It's fundamental, systematic. So you need to both fundamentally understand how does an asset relate to quote-unquote sustainability, which to me is the question of, well, how does it relate to the real world? When you buy an asset, what's its connection to the real world? What people are really saying in sustainable investing is, I care about that question. I want to know, how does this asset I'm owning relate to the real world? If it's a company, that answer is pretty simple. They make goods and services that the real world interacts with. And then the inputs to making the goods and services are in the real world. They're employing people. They have all these practices, so on and so forth. So that's the fundamental side. And then you have to systemize that. You have to measure it in a systematic way across multiple data sources. It's no harder of a problem, in my view, than the question of, for example, what is growth in China? That's a very hard question. There's a lot of different people with different answers to that question. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of questions about how authoritative the data is and whether people are really telling you everything they're seeing. You have to build a systematic process to say, how do I process all of this data and know what's happening in China? It's too important of a question to invest in the world and not have a view on Chinese conditions. We've basically just translated that approach that we've used for many years to sustainability. Saying, let's do the same thing with sustainability. Data spot for problems. People mean lots of different things. Be clear what we mean. Measure it as systematically as possible.
A lot of our listeners are running or senior positions in the asset management industry across the world. And there's always a discussion about this trade-off between size and returns. And Bridgewater is, as we said earlier on, done extraordinarily well. And we had a question from a previous guest, Jack Edmondson, who's deputy CIO at Oxford University Endowment. And he said, is size an advantage or disadvantage given your assets today?
It does matter which assets you're in. If you look at Bridgewater, we basically invest in the most liquid, deepest markets in the world. So we've chosen to make our playground an area where you can actually put a lot of money to work. I don't see a lot of ways it's an advantage, but I do think that understanding at what point it becomes a problem really requires a deep understanding of how much transaction costs you're paying in different sizes and how those relationships work, and constantly measuring the realistic market depth, which does change. You do get big shifts, obviously extreme cases like Russia's markets can't even be transacted in, but day to day, they change a lot more. So no, for us to be anywhere near a size, even if we're a 20th of the size, we have a pretty serious operation to constantly measure the depth of market liquidity, understand at what point we have impact and in what ways, and then relate that to the type of views we have to say, okay, what does that mean? How big can we be in what places? Bridgewater, if you look at our history, we've closed funds before, we've capped certain sizes. We've been pretty proactive in saying, We're going to look at how conditions evolve and decide based on that what we think a prudent size is, that it's realistic to transact in those markets we transact in, which are very liquid. If you said to me, please go restart Bridgewater in a set of markets that are significantly less liquid, you just have to be in a different size because the nature of our insights just wouldn't allow that to translate.
Changing tack in a slightly ironic twist, you and I had a conversation last week and you had referred in a different interview to Michael Lewis's book, The Undoing Project. And I've just done a podcast with Michael Lewis and it'll be out the week before you. And it's absolutely terrific. But he had in that book applied and discussed the lessons from one of your former professors at Princeton in this great study about why data trumps human intuition. And I wonder whether, having studied as you had and learned and admired it, whether you've actually been able to take anything from that and apply it to the money management business.
Oh, absolutely. I think Bridgewater's whole investment philosophy wouldn't have jumped off the page and spoken to me if I hadn't studied under Danny Kahneman. Because I think I came in already deeply believing the challenges with human intuition. I'd never want to invest in a black box where we have no idea what's happening. But there's a big difference between investing black box and just relying on your intuitions. So I came in already primed to believe that there were a lot of tools that could help you and that intuition was flawed and biased and it mattered what mood you were in, whether or not you had a good breakfast that morning, and if you happened to hear something in the news that morning that got you thinking in a different direction, you could make pretty logical decisions based on that. And I think Bridgewater's investment philosophy is basically intended to counter those biases, basically intended to say, we want to get the best of human intuition and then use all the best tools we can to limit the biases humans have. I'm sure we don't limit them all, but we're very, very aware of them and trying to systemize around them. Kahneman and Tversky did incredible work highlighting and illustrating in a very real way what those flaws are in a way that both feels personal to people and makes them realize the challenges they're probably running into in their professional lives by relying just on intuition.
Now, we both know that the investment journey is lined with turbulence and setbacks. Your career path has flourished. Why do you think you've managed to succeed so far?
I really feel the biggest driver was the tremendous investment that Bridgewater put into me. Ray Dalio, Greg Jensen, Bob Prince, three chief investment officers. I mean, they've worked together for 60 years or something combined, if you do all the bilaterals. They put tremendous time and effort into teaching and training me. And honestly, all three of them many times believed in me a lot faster than I did myself. They saw more in me faster than I did in myself. And I can't say enough about the fact that, I know a lot's been said about Bridgewater's culture, but they never held back. They never sat and thought, this is just a 20-something-year-old that just graduated from college. At the worst case, she's a girl. She'll be sad. She'll be upset. I don't want to upset her. Let me be nicer about that feedback. They were always extremely blunt and said, this is bad. This is a problem. And paired that with giving me a lot of challenges and forcing me to take on bigger and bigger things. And I just think if they had either obviously put less time into me or held back, thought, I wouldn't want to upset her too much. There's just no way I could have grown the way that I did. So I feel like I owe a tremendous amount to all three of them and their mentorship. And I'm sure it's common. I'm sure everyone you interview tells you that someone mentored them well. But I do think that they were unique in how quickly they allowed me to grow and take on new challenges. And they couldn't have done it without very clear and harsh feedback. I'm sure there's tons of stories of Bridgewater, of me fighting with all three of them in very blunt ways.
How do you think you describe yourself as a colleague?
I'm very passionate about what I do. I really believe in the people I work with. It's very rare for me to spend a lot of time with someone that I don't really believe in and see very unique talent in. I really pride myself in people that I saw talent in before others did and gave them opportunities that others didn't. But I think I definitely dole out harsh feedback when needed and try not to hold back because I know it helped me along the way. I recall nights that are like 9 p.m., calling up Ray Dalio saying, this piece you want to send out to clients is just bad. Let me tell you what I think about it, when I know nobody wants to get that call at 9 p.m. But that's the standards we have for ourselves, which is we have to do that for each other or our stuff won't be good.
Terrific. I'm going to ask you a few more general questions. I know you're an active angel investor focusing on technology startups, particularly led by women. Tell me what's particularly exciting you in the companies you're investing in.
Honestly, for me, because I'm not really a technology investor, it's the people. There's just so many talented people in recent years have been able to get funding, start their own ideas. And I feel like I'm rarely the person that knows better that their technology is going to be successful. more often to someone who worked for me, someone I know personally, someone I believe in the person. And the person matters more than the idea often. And I know there's a lot of research about the gap of women in particular getting those first checks, because it's a lot on faith. So you're going on, does this look like a founder to me? Does it feel like a founder to me? There isn't as much evidence. So I felt strongly from the beginning of, if there are women that I believe in, that could help other investors see the promise as well. That could help get over the hump that someone who had hired them or trained them thinks that they're great and thinks that they're capable.
So I know you've worked with the nonprofit Seeds of Peace since you were a teenager, and you're familiar with lots of the challenges around the Middle East. And I wonder whether you think there could be a surprise out there in the landscape for the Middle East and less fracture and disharmony that investors right now certainly aren't paying attention to. Geopolitically, people aren't paying attention to.
I think the Abraham Accords were a big upside surprise. We're only starting to see the way that Israel's relationships with some of the Gulf countries, countries like Morocco, could lead to really successful financial ties. It could lead to things people aren't expecting. To what extent it's already priced into most of these economies in the Middle East, except for Israel, honestly don't have very much markets. And so almost any development there is a real upside. And I'm very hopeful for those broader relationships.
Three closing questions. What do you want to achieve in the next 10 years that you haven't achieved yet?
I'd really love for sustainable investing to be not just mainstream, but analytically rigorous, and something that the most rigorous investors say, this is how I approach it, this is why I do it, these are the ways that I achieve my goals. I would really like to be a part of that journey. I think investors really want and need to be able to incorporate sustainability in a way that makes sense and doesn't sacrifice their other goals and is rigorous and analytical.
Your favorite book, your favorite place to go on holiday, and your favorite piece of music?
Music, I wouldn't have said this before my daughter was born, but we have an animated What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. It was always a great song, but now it's something that I also share with her. And the music is an easy one to share with kids, and it comes animated, and we probably listen to it 10 times a week. So I'd probably put What a Wonderful World as an amazing, optimistic piece that everyone should listen to with their children. Place to go on holiday. I grew up in Israel. I come back here a lot, but I always enjoy a holiday where I can go somewhere I've never been and learn something new. And so it's a totally different kind of holiday than going back to where it's familiar. Italy has proven to be the most versatile in terms of, you always feel like you can go to a different region and suddenly a different experience. Highly recommend Sicily. A lot of people don't go there, and Sicilians will tell you they are not Italian. Absolutely not. And wow, so many books. Let me think. Should have thought about this before of what books do. I'll do a geeky book rather than a book that is like a heart favorite. I think it's just underread. So I like talking about it because it's, I think it's an underread book for how valuable it is. There's a book called How China Escaped the Poverty Trap by Yuan Yuan Eng that I think is some of the most insightful I've read, given how little people ever mention this book, for really getting into what do you make of the China puzzle? How is China able to do things that no other country has been able to do? It might be a little bit on the geeky political science side for a lot of listeners, but I think it's quite insightful and talks about the paradoxes of how a country that has corruption and bad institutions and all these issues was able to leap ahead in, I think, a very clever, different methodology than most of what I read about China. So recommended.
Great. And finally, what are you most grateful for in your life?
Without a doubt, family. It's centering. It makes you realize what's most important. And it puts in perspective when things are and are not going well, what your most important goals and grounding need to be. I'll add to that friends who've known me for a long time, because people who really know who you are. It's not a moment of the day relationship you have just through some work or whatnot. They'll see things in you you don't see in yourself. They'll tell you things other people won't tell you. They'll make you reflect on things you don't otherwise. Those are deep, meaningful relationships to enjoy and be thankful for.
Well, Karen, I know we're out of time. I have really enjoyed talking to you, and you have confirmed what many of us have maybe not articulated as well as you, is there is a new world order upon us, and many in the money management industry, for all sorts of historic reasons, are, if not tied to a benchmark, are finding it difficult to contemplate what portfolios should look like. And it sounds like with your very detailed systematic approach at Bridgewater, have moved already in some important way. And there are two other points I wrote down, the two S's, systematic and sustainable. And that's the sustainability that is becoming increasingly embedded that you really want to see become just a way of life almost, so it isn't part of these types of conversation. And the book recommendation I'm going to take away is How China Escaped the Poverty Trap. So we'll put that on our show notes as well. So Karen, thank you. It's been absolutely terrific to have this conversation today.
Thank you, Simon. I'm a fan, enjoyed listening, so it's an honor to be on.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.